and welcome to the SAGE podcast of Critical Sociology's Labor Scholar Series. I'm Graham Cassano, Culture and Media Editor for Critical Sociology. Ruth Milkman is Professor of Sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center and Professor and Academic Director of the Joseph S. Murphy Institute for Worker Education and Labor Studies. Professor Milkman is the author of numerous works on the history and sociology of American labor. Recently, we had the opportunity to talk about her policy report, written with Laura Breslow, The State of the Unions 2011, A Profile of Organized Labor in New York City, New York State, and the United States. What are the major difficulties facing American workers as they attempt to organize or preserve their unions and organizations?
Well, one point we make in the report is that the gap between private sector and public sector unionism is at a historical high. It's never been this wide. So in the U.S. as a whole, in the private sector, unionism was below 7%, 6.9%. I believe it's even a little lower now. In the public sector, it was 36.5%. That's an enormous difference. And now there's a new attack mounting, as we've seen, especially in Wisconsin, but in a number of other states too, on the collective bargaining rights of public sector workers, kind of because that's the only thing left standing. And so people who would like there not to be a strong labor movement are now focused on that.
I liked also the way you broke down the numbers. And I guess what I found revealing, although I shouldn't have been surprised by this, was that in the United States, the plurality of union members have college, four-year college degrees now, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, that's a direct reflection of what we were just talking about. In other words, it's because the public sector is the most highly organized sector, and that is a sector that employs, for example, tons of teachers who are college educated almost by definition, as well as healthcare professionals, most of whom are college educated. People like that are among the most highly unionized groups today. So the old sort of, you know, stereotypical image we all have in our heads of the kind of hard hat union member, white male, cigar chomping, whatever, is really obsolete. There are still people like that, but they are less likely to be unionized than teachers, nurses, and so on. So, and government, clerical workers, administrative assistants, and people like that.
Has the changing union constituency changed the politics of unions?
You know, I don't really think it's the changing union constituency that's changed it. It's more the popular mistrust of government intervention, which undermines any social democratic initiatives all by itself. This kind of anti-statist, anti-tax fervor that swept the country as a whole, less so in here in New York, but even here to some extent. The obsession with, you know, not having budget deficits, which starves public sector social provision. All those things have really undermined, along with the deunionization of the country, the old New Deal kind of era culture that we had. I mean, look, the big changes all happen at the same time, so it's hard to know what's causing what. So you have, I call them the three Ds, deunionization, deindustrialization, and deregulation, all sort of taking off big time in the late 1970s and continuing since then. And then on top of that, and related to all those things, enormous growth in income inequality and erosion of the real earnings of non-college educated workers, especially men. So that's a huge piece of what happened too. And one of the reasons for that erosion is deunionization. It's not the only reason, but it's a big one. And you put that together with this, you know, attacks on the whole idea of government making provision for human needs, and you've got a recipe for, you know, enormous growth in inequality, which is even understated in many of the official statistics that we see all the time, you know, thanks to Occupy Wall Street and so on, because the inequalities are not just in income, and they're not even just in wealth, although, you know, wealth inequality is even bigger than income inequality in scale, but all sorts of other things. Think about pensions, healthcare. Affluent workers, professionals and managers still have a lot of those things. Well, pensions, even they don't have in the private sector. These are things that unions fought for, of course. And low-wage workers tend to have nothing. And then there's another factor, which is that in households, people tend to get together with people of a similar social class status. So professionals marry or live with professionals. Working class people do the same. Poor people do the same. And now that in almost all households, if there's two adults, they both are in the labor force, that already multiplies the inequality by a factor of two just by itself. And that wasn't the case in the mid-20th century when it was much less common for two people to be employed outside the home. So there's just been these enormous shifts. The labor movement historically has been, you know, one of the few voices representing the disadvantaged part of the society in a kind of serious way, with a lot of resources and, you know, smarts behind it. And it's still doing that to some extent. But, you know, as unions get weaker and weaker, the danger really is there now that that will just end. And that would be a real loss to democracy, to the voice of people who don't have a lot of power and privilege in the political system. And I feel like that is what we're in the process of witnessing.
So I was wondering if you could describe or explain the concept of the Worker Center and describe some of your recent work with these.
Sure. So Worker Centers popped up starting in the 90s. Basically, there's a few that are a little older than that, but the big numbers appear in the 90s and since. And the numbers continue to grow. And they're basically NGOs, and is what they'd be called in the rest of the world, non-governmental organizations, but that are focused on work and labor issues. Most of them, in practice, recruit and advocate on behalf of immigrant workers, just because immigrants are so highly concentrated in the low-wage labor market. But these are organizations that try to improve the situation of the very the most disadvantaged workers. And this is important for several reasons. One is that, rightly or wrongly, usually wrongly, the public often associates labor unions with relatively privileged workers. You know, unions did win higher wages for many of their members and benefits and so on that a lot of workers don't have today. So there's a certain amount of hostility to unions based on that they think these people are fat cats who are, you know, living off some kind of privilege or something. That's a wildly exaggerated stereotype, but it's out there. But no one can say that about immigrant workers who work as day laborers or domestic workers or taxi drivers or, you know, restaurant dishwashers or and so on. These are people who earn at best the minimum wage in many cases, and in fact are the main victims of what's come to be called wage theft, where people are paid less than the minimum wage illegally by their employers. So they're, insofar as these organizations succeed in shining a bright light on those kind of abuses, they do get a lot of public sympathy. And so they've been fairly successful in doing that around the country. They exist, there's a couple hundred of them now around the country, mostly in big cities, but in some, there are exceptions to that. And the difference between them and labor unions, though, is that they don't collect dues. They have very, very limited resources. Most of them survive on foundation grants or donations from individuals or some combination of that. A few do collect dues, but in a very irregular way. Very few of them have any role in collective bargaining. So they're not really unions, although they are workers' organizations. They're very vibrant, very creative. They do really well in, you know, attracting media attention to workplace issues. They're much more effective these days, I think, overall on that terrain than labor unions are. And yet there are real limitations on what's possible in terms of scale, because they're such tiny organizations. A typical worker center has, you know, a handful of staff people and a tiny budget. So they've done an amazing amount considering those limitations, but they're not really the same animal as organized labor in that respect. Organized labor, because of its ability to collect dues and the millions of workers it still represents, you know, has enormous resources by comparison, and therefore, you know, more influence, at least in certain arenas. There was some tension between the two in the beginning when the worker centers first emerged. A lot of them were kind of hostile to labor unions. They, in fact, came into being in part because some of the leaders felt that unions were not doing a good job of representing immigrant workers and other low-wage workers who were not in traditional forms of employment, but were in more precarious forms of work where they didn't necessarily have a stable employer and so on. And at the same time, the unions were sort of suspicious, like, who are these new kids on the block? What are they up to? They're not really unions. They're not serious. They don't have any money. So there was a lot of tension between them. And there's a great article about that by Janice Fine. It's called A Marriage Made in Heaven, about the tensions between the two. That has really changed, though, I'd say, in the last 10 years or so, where partly out of, you know, recognition of how desperate their own plight is, the organized labor has really turned around. And I think the marches of immigrant workers in 2006 made it obvious to anyone who didn't understand this before that there was enormous potential in organizing immigrant workers. And so for all those reasons, organized labor has really embraced the movement to the point where just a year or so ago, they affiliated into the AFL-CIO for the first time in like a century. They gave a charter to a new organization, which was not really a union, which was the New York Taxi Workers Association. And they have more informal partnerships with a couple other labor centers as well. So Domestic Workers United has some support from the AFL-CIO as well. And the Laborers Union, which represents relatively low-skilled construction workers, has a relationship with Endelon, the National Day Laborers Organizing Network. So we're beginning to see more and more of these kind of partnerships. And the worker centers themselves have become much more interested in the possibility of collective bargaining for their own constituencies than was the case when they first started. So there's a kind of convergence, I think, beginning to develop between the two. And I see this as sort of the best hope for labor revitalization, which, again, isn't saying a whole lot given how bleak things are overall. But this is where the dynamic activity is for the most part. So I think the partnership is kind of exciting in that, the, you know, in potentially this marriage could be one where the AFL-CIO and Change to Win, the other big federation of unions, kind of offer some help in the way of resources, which, despite everything, the unions still have substantial resources, to these very small organizations, which have great ideas, wonderful campaigns, a lot of imagination and effectiveness in winning the hearts and minds of the public, but very little in the way of staff or money. So insofar as they work together, it could be a really good thing.
Thank you to Professor Ruth Milkman.
Thanks to Roz Hartigan for engineering and production.
This podcast series was made possible in part through a grant from Wayne State University. I'm Graham Cassano, culture and media editor for Critical Sociology. Critical Sociology is a quarterly journal published by Sage. For more information, please visit our website, crs.sagepub.com.